Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama had this to say Friday about last month's weak job report.
Now, make no mistake, we are headed in the right direction. But as I was reminded on a trip to Racine, Wisconsin earlier this week, we're not headed there fast enough for a lot of Americans.
Joining me in the studio to discuss exactly where the U.S. economy is headed, Dean Baker with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, The Wall Street Journal's David Wessel, and Ray Hederman with the Heritage Foundation. We invite you to join us as well, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
David Wessel, what are the most clear indications about where the economy is headed, or are there any?
Oh, there's lots of indications. The problem is they're not all pointing in the same direction. Basically, it looks like an economy which is growing, which is a good thing. It's bigger than it was a year ago. Some things are doing better. Manufacturing is doing a little better. But I think the best read is that the momentum of the economy has slowed at a time when that wasn't the plan. And so we're going into the second half of the year where the growth may be slower than the first half at a time when we still have huge unemployment. Almost 20% of the office buildings in America are empty. When a quarter of all Americans who have mortgages owe more money on their mortgage than the value of the house. So it's not time. It's not a good time for things to start leveling off. And I think that's the concern.
Dean Baker, how do you see it?
Well, I'd say similar to what David just said, but perhaps a little worse. Basically, we're looking at a situation where the economy is growing rather weakly in the first half of the year and almost certain to grow more weakly, and perhaps even we could actually see a double dip in the second half. Basic point here is if we look at final demand, we had very good growth number in the fourth quarter of 2009 and a good number, reasonable number, at least in the first quarter of this year. That was driven by inventories. Firms were rebuilding the inventories. That's coming to an end. So if you look at final demand, just pulling out the inventories, in the first quarter, that grew at just a 1% rate. Now, on top of that, going into the second half of the year, we're looking at a weakening of the housing market because we've withdrawn the tax credit. State and local governments are making cutbacks just about everywhere because they have large deficits. The stimulus will be fading down, not so much in the second half, but early 2011. And on top of that, as house prices fall again, we're going to see consumers cutting back more. So I'm looking at an economy that's growing very, very weakly, if at all, which is not where you want to be right now.
Right. Hederman, we did have some jobs created last month.
Exactly. The private sector is still expanding. The pace of acceleration in the second quarter is slightly faster than the first quarter. So the labor market is improving, but in fits and starts. It's kind of we're taking two steps forward, one step back, and there's no doubt that the job report released last Friday was a step back. We're now 9 months into this recovery. We're still trying to look at the green shoots when we kind of want a more flowering plant at this point. And so the recovery, unfortunately, as David mentioned, has seemed to have slowed a little bit from a pretty robust spring. I think that's going to be a concern going forward. We're starting to see some forecasts lowering future job growth, lowering the economic growth over the latter half of the year and into next year.
Do you believe we're headed into a double dip recession?
Not at this time. I think what we're going to see is going to see a very, very slow, you know, we'll hear more complaints about the jobless recovery. We've got to remember after 2001, we didn't see robust job growth till 2 years after the recession ended. You know, we're still just 9 months into the recovery. The other thing to realize is that this is a very tough recession in the economic predicament. We know that financial crises are much harder to recover from than more a traditional economic slowdown that we saw in 2001. So anticipate a steady recovery, but very, very slow. And I'm not as concerned about a double dip right now.
The Associated Press is reporting that the Institute for Supply Management says the pace of service sector growth has slowed in June. Employees' hiring plans have shrunk. ISM says the service sector growth is yet another sign that growth could weaken in the second half of 2010, David.
Well, I think that's sort of consistent with what we've been seeing, that, we created jobs in June, but 83,000 private sector jobs, 7.9 million to go before we get back to where we were. So I think it's troubling because, and I'm sure we'll get to this, it's not clear what is likely to happen to get the engine running faster, whether there's anything that the government will actually do to do it, to
or
change it.
Or could do.
I think there's a big debate about could. There seems to be very little debate about whether. And if the business community is somehow lacking in confidence, which seems to be their song at the moment, and is reluctant to hire and invest, and if people are just a little bit worried about the housing market, about the stock market, about their job security and stuff, and they all say, well, maybe I'll put off that vacation or spend a little less money, that's a recipe for something that's rather disappointing.
What about David's point as to what the government can, should, or might do, Dean Baker?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, first off, I think it has to do something. This is really a catastrophe. We're talking about around 15 million people unemployed. And just important to understand, these people aren't unemployed because they're lazy or they lack the skills. They're unemployed because the people running the economy messed up in a really big way. Unfortunately, people running the economy still have their jobs. But in any case, the point is we have to try to do something. We don't just sit back and say, you know, too bad we messed up, you're going to suffer. What can we do? Well, I'll be a little more optimistic, a little more pessimistic than David. I don't see any real hope on consumption because people have lost trillions of dollars of housing wealth. They've lost stock wealth as well. They're not spending. It's not because they have bad attitudes. They're not spending because the same reason homeless people don't spend. They don't have the money. So we're not going to see a rebound in consumption. Investments, you know, firms, you know, they're going to complain about taxes. They'll complain about everything in the world. But the reality is if they don't see the demand there, they're not going to invest. So in the short term, I see the only real story here is government has to provide the boost. I don't see anyone else to fill that gap. Over the longer term, what we really should be looking to do is improve our net export situation, our trade situation. But that's not something that can be done overnight. And lately, we've been going the wrong way because we've seen the dollar soar. It has to fall. So we have to go the other way. But that's not something that can happen overnight. So in the short term, I see government as the only way in which we can boost the economy, create jobs.
The only way, Ray.
Well, I think businesses right now are very concerned about what the government is doing. Corporations are sitting on some of their largest cash reserves that we've seen in five decades. And that's because, obviously, they're concerned about the macroeconomic situation, but they're also concerned about policies coming out of Washington. Let's remember that we're looking at a very large tax increase coming forward. The majority of states are going to be taxing dividends, for example, at over 50% when you include the federal and state dividend tax rates. So corporations are taking a look and they're saying, man, we're being subject to new regulations we've never had. We're being a lot more bureaucratic power has been expanded in the last couple of years. So businesses are sitting there saying, we're going to sit on the sidelines. We're not going to hire. We're going to use productivity gains and temporary workers instead of trying to hire a lot of full-time jobs. So that's kind of the situation we're in. I think, you know, Dean's point about looking at exports and trade as a leading growth indicator is going to be very key. The president has made, I think, some real promising talks about moving forward on the trade front this week. He's talking about renegotiating trade agreements with Colombia, South Korea. And I think, you know, this export sector is going to be very key because we're going to have to look elsewhere from Europe, which obviously has its own economic problems.
David, what about problems in the housing market? Are they one huge reason the economy won't rebound?
Well, they're definitely a big reason. But, you know, it's not a new development. The housing industry collapsed. We had a bubble in housing. It fell. It means that it'll be a long time before we put lots of people to work building houses or even building office buildings. And as Dean points out, it's hard to – people are poorer when their houses aren't worth much. You know, I saw some data that was really disturbing about when you look at the fraction of people in some communities who own a house and actually have some equity in it. In places like Las Vegas, it's below 40%. And so it will definitely be a drag. But I don't think anybody, even the most optimistic person, thought that somehow housing was going to pull us out of this, which was one of the things that was going to make this recovery better. The hope was housing would stop being a negative and maybe be a slight positive, and other things would pick up the slack. but we're kind of in search of those other things. It's not going to be Europe. We hope it's going to be exports, but that's hard if the rest of the world is not growing very fast, and it's hard if the dollar's rising. It would be nice if it was a lot of business investment and things that would pay off in the future, and there is some promising evidence about business capital investment. It would be nice if this were the moment where we had some great discovery that suddenly put people to work in biotech or something. But we're all searching for that something, and I think what Dean's pointing out is when there's no something in the private sector, the argument's going to be, should the government do more? Or did we learn from this that the government can't fix this problem?
Before we get to what the government can and cannot do, Dean Baker, you've got a solution for the housing problem.
You do, Dean? Is that right?
Well, I have part of a solution. I mean, one of the things that I've been trying to push is just most immediately, how do you help the homeowners who have lost equity in their home, many of whom are underwater? And what I've proposed is give people the right to stay in their house as renters for a substantial period of time, paying the market rent for 5 years after a foreclosure. Now, that's not a great situation for them, but it's much better than being thrown out on the street.
How do you determine the market rent? Is it a portion of the mortgage, or how do you determine that?
You would have an appraiser, just as you have an appraiser, you know, if you're getting a mortgage, you have an appraiser come in, determine the market sale price. It'd be the same sort of thing. An appraiser would come in after a foreclosure, if someone wants to take advantage of this rental option, and they would determine what comparable units are renting for in the area. So it would be determined by an independent party.
Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's the author of Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. David Wessel is economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. Rafe Hederman is with the Heritage Foundation. And welcome back. As we talk about the U.S. economy, concerns in every sector, and particularly in the housing market. President Obama last Friday signed a 3-month extension of the home buyer credit, but that home buyer credit applies only to a certain segment of the population, David.
Right. This was basically like giving people a coupon to buy a house. And if you buy a house, you get an $8,000 tax credit if you qualify. And the problem was that if you had to buy the house by April 30th and finish the paperwork by June 30th, and even though we're in the 21st century, apparently buying a house is still in the 18th century, and so the paperwork takes a long time. And so Congress extended it to take care of the people who had already done the deal and just hadn't finished the paperwork. I frankly think it's an open question whether the solution to our problems is to continue to put tax credit into housing. I mean, after all, one reason we got into this mess was that we overdid it on housing. We said, in my opinion, that you had to own a house to be a card-carrying member of the American middle class. Well, I just don't think that's right. I think that it would be fine to have people who rent. People ought to have good housing. There's no doubt about that. But this over-celebration of home ownership for people who really couldn't afford to maintain the house and the mortgage, I think was a mistake. And if I were designing some government stimulus, I think I'd look for ways to give an oomph to things outside of housing rather than in housing myself.
Dean.
Yeah, I agree 100% with everything what David just said there. But one other point I just want to make about the tax credit that really sort of irked me was that They extended it for 3 months for people who had already signed by April 30th. Now, some people clearly were in this boat where they weren't able to close by June 30th, and fine, give them another 15 days, 30 days. But the idea you'd give an extra 3 months, I think this is just inviting fraud. We're going to have a lot of people backdating contracts that, you know, they'll backdate a contract they signed today or next week or the week after and have it signed April 25th. And it's just not good policy to encourage tax fraud.
Right.
Yeah. It's a terrible economic policy. And what you're seeing is every time right before the credit ends, you see a big surge in home purchases. And then you saw the biggest drop off in home sales in 40 years when the tax credit dropped. So what you're doing is you're subsidizing a great deal on housing for a very, very short period of time. You're not getting any recovery in the housing market. You know, I think David's absolutely right about we need to take a look at how much we're subsidizing housing policy. We could take a look at the mortgage interest deduction, which is now one of the more expensive tax expenditures in the tax code, and say, hey, maybe we should limit that, make it no longer a deduction, move it to a tax credit, take it out of the tax code.
Boy, how old you'd hear about that?
Well, it's one of those things, again, it's basically subsidizing people to buy more expensive housing. And so it's a terrible tax policy, and I really think, you know, it's something that we should take a look at, trying to rein it in some type in the future, and that would give us a more sustainable housing market.
You said more expensive housing, but how much do you all expect housing prices to continue to drop, David?
I don't really know. I think it's hard to say. It seems like the big plunge is past. So we seem to be bumping along a bottom, and the question is whether it'll gradually start to get better or whether there'll be something that makes it continue to go down. I bet Dean thinks they're going to continue down. I think it's like trying to predict the weather 3 months from now. You can do it, but you wouldn't want anybody to remember what you said.
I'm used to people remembering what I said. But I'll say about another 15%, 10 to 15% or so. Because if you look at the pattern, house prices rose through the fall of 2009 based on the tax credit, because the original credit expired November 30th. So clearly a lot of people are rushing to buy homes before the expiration. Then the market just weakened enormously. House prices began to fall again. We saw a jump up with the most recent data, but clearly that was driven by the tax credit. Now there's huge oversupply of housing. The demand side of the market's fallen through the floor. I expect they'll start falling again probably fairly rapidly by the second half of the year.
All right. It's worth noting that mortgage rates are very low. So for people
quite
who
good.
Have the wherewithal to buy a house, and if there may be people who are take advantage of this dip that we see now.
As we talked about what the government can and cannot do, do you believe the government should extend unemployment benefits, Ray?
I think given this fact that the private sector now is starting to expand, we are seeing job growth, that the government needs to start capping down this unemployment extension benefits. It's been over a year now. We're seeing the unemployment rate, you know, hold steady, even fall sometimes as the private sector is expanding. And so we know that from empirical evidence that extending unemployment insurance extends the period of unemployment. And so the government just can't keep transferring these money, racking up the deficit. So I think the government needs to start drawing a harder line saying, look, no more extensions. The economy's starting to recover. Let's see if we can keep taxes low, keep the deficit low, and that'll produce more productive economic growth.
Dean Baker, is it time to worry about the deficit?
I'm hard-pressed to see that. I mean, you know, we've had this trumpeting that the deficit's going to cause the bond market to go wild, and it keeps going the wrong way. The interest rates keep falling. And if we just look at where we've been historically, we look at other countries. Japan has a debt-to-GDP ratio. It's over 200%. They could borrow long-term at less than 2%. So this idea of the bond market vigilantes are about to crack down on us, I think this is kind of a myth.
What about this argument, David Wetzel, between the White House and the Congress over stimulus spending and whether to pay attention to the deficit or whether to try to stimulate the economy?
Well, I think it's a fascinating moment in our economic political history, because one wouldn't have expected at this point, with 6.8 million people out of work, 6.8 million people out of work for more than 6 months, more than half of them out of work for more than a year, that this would be the moment that the American people started worrying about the deficit. Yet when in the polls that we've done at the Wall Street Journal and others have done, there does seem to be this sense among the people that the deficit is a problem. And I think that the members of Congress are reflecting that thing. And it's a bit puzzling, I think, to people who would say, well, why would people want to have spending cuts and tax increases now, given how bad the economy is? And I think there are a couple of things. There are, of course, people who just don't believe that big government is a solution to problems. And so they are upset about what the government's done and are pushing back.
And they have very loud voices.
Right. But I think also there's a lot of other people who are saying something that goes like this. President Obama came in with a $787 billion stimulus, and the Fed did all this stuff. And all we have to show for it is an economy which is bumping along in all this misery. And I'm not convinced, these people say, that more of this medicine will cure the patient. So I think part of it reflects a frustration among people. Now, a whole lot of economists would say, yeah, but it could have been worse. We could have had more unemployment if we hadn't had this government stimulus. But as the source of all great laugh lines about the financial crisis, Barney Frank, says, nobody ever got elected to Congress with the slogan, it would have been worse if not for me. And I think you can hear it in the president's rhetoric and in Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman's rhetoric, this kind of plea. But it could have been worse if we hadn't done all this stuff. And nobody believes it.
Nobody knows for sure.
Of course not.
Dean Baker.
Well, a couple things. First off, I think it is important to realize how small the stimulus actually was relative to the shortfall in the economy. So when you look at that $787 million, about $80 billion was a fixed the alternative minimum tax. That's not stimulus in anyone's book. About $100 billion or so that was going to be spent in later years, 2011, 12, 13, however long out. You're looking at around $300 billion a year in stimulus for 2009, 2010, roughly half of which was offset by cutbacks at the state and local level. So we were trying to fill a hole of around $1.2 trillion in lost private sector demand with $150 billion in net government stimulus. It just isn't up to that.
How about that, Ray?
Well, I think it's important to remember that we've had two stimulus bills already. You know, President Bush enacted in 2008 about $150 billion. So we've pumped about $1 trillion back into the economy with very little to show for it. And I think it's time to take a look and say, hey, you know what? This isn't working. We know that we haven't been able to spin ourselves out of the past. Japan, you know, for example, has been spending hand over fist to try to get out of their lost decade of the 1990s and doesn't have a whole lot to show for it other than higher debt, shiny new bridges, but their economy is still just kind of bumping along. That's why I think people are sitting there saying, you know, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you. We've tried two stimulus bills, over $1 trillion in new spending. The economy hasn't responded the way we look for. Let's look to something else. Because people are realizing, they're taking a look saying, you know, I'm going to be on the hook for all this debt. People know that their taxes are going to go up, and people are anticipating that. And they realize, I'd rather be spending the money myself than having a government bureaucrat deciding how to spend it.
Interesting, David Wessel at the G20. President Obama seemed to be of another mind than many of his international contemporaries.
Well, I think there was a little bit more made of that than was actually occurred there because people were looking for a storyline. It's pretty clear that a number of European governments have been forced by the markets to curtail their deficits. The UK, Spain, Greece, of course, Portugal. In Germany, though, the rhetoric of austerity is greater than the actual austerity, because for them, it seems to be politically appealing to talk about austerity. In the U.S., the president had this problem of he kind of wants them to step on the gas now and put the step on the brake later, and that turns out to be pretty complicated. But there's definitely a difference in emphasis. The president of the United States says we ought to worry first about growth, and then we'll deal with the deficit later. And a number of the European countries are saying the way to get growth is to somehow do the deficit reduction now, restore the confidence of the markets, and all good things will happen afterwards. And so you end up with this mush out of the G20 communique where they all agree on the eternal verities that growth is better than depression, and we'll try and work to make it better.
A couple of important differences between Europe and the United States, at least the Eurozone countries, they don't have their own currency. So you have countries like Spain, Greece, they're really subject. They're like Arkansas. You know, Arkansas, if they go into a really bad debt situation, unless the federal government bails them out, they have to deal directly with the markets. The U.S. government isn't like that. We control the Fed. The other really important point that you know, I get sort of frustrated because I'd love to see more stimulus in Europe, but I look at a country like Germany. They have 7% unemployment today. That's lower than what they went into this with. Part of this is because they have a very innovative practice, work sharing. Instead of laying people off, the government encourages employers to reduce work hours. So instead of experiencing this downturn in the form of double-digit unemployment, they experience a downturn in the form of shorter work weeks and longer vacations. I wish we would go that route.
What do you think, Ray?
Well, I think one of the things you're seeing, you know, Dean talks about the U.S. bond market going down. One of the reasons is because a lot of investors are suffering flight to quality because of the woes of Europe. And so you're seeing that the United States isn't subject to the same pressures because, you know, the dollar, our bonds are still one of the safest investments going. So people who used to invest over in Europe are sitting there saying, we don't like the direction that Europe is going, the EU with their debt situation. So they're moving dollars over here. And that's to our benefit in the short term. But on the other hand, it means that the dollar goes up. It means it's much harder for us to get our goods into Europe, which is going to slow our recovery.
But you've also said, Ray, that businesses need to be calmed down, that they're sitting on tons of cash.
That's absolutely right. And so businesses are sitting there, they're taking a look and say, I want to hold my dollars in reserve for as long as possible to know, number one, the recovery is completely sure. And then I know, number two, how Washington is going to impact me going forward.
Yeah, well, I'd agree, certainly waiting on the recovery. We know that the most important factor determining investment is demand growth, and businesses just don't see that now. If you look sector after sector, where is it that a firm is going to say, we have to be expanding right now in order to meet the demand a year or 2 years out? You're very hard-pressed to find where that sector is.
Dean Baker, the Economic and Policy Research Center, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's our first email. It's from Alan, who says, how much of an impact would there be on the deficit if tax rates for individuals making $200,000 or more were increased to the same rates as paid under Ronald Reagan? Ray.
It depends on which tax rates under Ronald Reagan, because there were two. There was the pre-1986 and then the post-1986. So I would guess, you know, ballpark, you'd be looking at about $400 billion in new taxes on those individuals if you're looking at roughly a rate around 31%.
A year or over 10 years?
Over 10. And so, but the problem is the trade-off with that is depending on what you did with some of the investment, you could see another slowdown in the stock market because the capital gains tax would go up. I think you're going to see companies altering the way they return gains to their shareholders because one of the big interesting points in tax policy right now is that dividends and capital gains are the tax at the same rate right now. After the end of this year, dividends will go up to a top rate of 39.6 plus another 3.8% under health care. So you're looking at one of the highest tax rates and dividends that we've seen since Carter.
Dean Baker.
Yeah, I wouldn't be that concerned about the higher dividend tax rate. We have had higher tax rates and done just fine with the more rapid growth. I would say, again, you're talking about the 31% rate. If we were to go back to the rate that Reagan originally had, of course, was 50%, we're probably talking about $300 billion a year in additional revenue at that tax rate. So that would be a way to raise a fair bit of money.
All right, let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Pardon me, to Fort Myers Beach, Florida. Good morning, Matt. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the air.
Of course.
It's wonderful to hear everybody talking about the housing bubble on the air this morning. I think down here I'm very concerned that there's not going to be any incentive for, once the economy does rebound, for a place like Fort Myers, which is really built on, its economic success seems to be really built on the housing bubble. What policies will be put in place to ensure that they don't just simply return to that form of growth after our economy finally does rebound to some degree?
David Wetzel.
Well, that's a good question. I think that it's going to be harder for people who can't afford a mortgage to get one for a while, and that will definitely make a big difference. But that'll wear off, and I think we'll see over a decade whether the American infatuation with home ownership has just taken a break or whether it returns. But there may be places like Florida and Arizona and Nevada that grew extremely rapidly by building lots of new houses and then people moving there, and then that provided demand for other things and lots of construction. They may not be the fast-growing parts of our country over the next
And here's a follow-up from Lindy in Dallas, Texas, who says, how do banks contribute to the slow growth? I know of several couples with good credit who wanted to buy a house but couldn't get a loan. I hear similar complaints from small businesses. Dean Baker.
Well, there is a story going around that has a lot of currency, that the big problem is that the banks aren't lending. I have to say I'm really skeptical on that. When it comes to home loans, there's sort of a simple measure that we should be seeing, we could follow, that tells us whether that's an issue or not. That's the Mortgage Bankers Association has a mortgage applications index. That should be skyrocketing because that's measuring applications. So if we had a lot of situations where people otherwise had good credit, they'd make their application and they wouldn't get a mortgage, we should see the number of applications soar relative to the number of sales. We're not seeing that at all. There's zero evidence of that. The other story, we have all these businesses, they're saying they had good credit, this and that, and now they can't get loans. Well, that happens in every business cycle downturn. The basic story here is that if you had a business, maybe it was going along just fine. Well, things are very different in 2009, 2010 than they were in 2007, 2000, start 2008. So a business that might have been a good credit risk when the economy was strong is no longer a good credit risk today.
Right.
I'm going to disagree slightly, because I think one of the interesting things is that we're no longer in the credit crunch they were back in 2008, but we still haven't seen the drop in credit, the expansion of credit that we might expect. And small businesses have been hit hard because a lot of them bank at your more community banks, your smaller banks, and a lot of them are heavily leveraged in the real estate sector, specifically the commercial real estate sector. So as these banks' balance sheets have dropped due to the real estate market, it's much harder for a small business to get a loan.
Ray Hederman, he's with the Heritage Foundation. When we come back, we'll get to more of your calls. Diane, Barbara, Aaron, Chris, Eva, hold on.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The Chevy Volt and other plug-in cars could revolutionize the auto industry. As part of our ongoing Environmental Outlook series, how electric cars could reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. It's time to go back to the phones. Let's go to Aaron, who's in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
Yes, and thank you for letting me put my two cents in.
Sure.
And first of all, I'd like to point out that slow growth is not necessarily bad. And I think as long as it's growing, but at a slower rate, it's often more effective than fast growth in the long run. And then I'd like to bring up the suggestion in terms of decreasing the full-time work week. More people would be employed that way, and we could share both the pain of the economic problems as well as the pleasures of having more time with our families and our communities.
All right. Thanks for calling. Fast growth versus slow growth, Dean?
Well, 2 points. Where we are now, you're looking at the result of slow growth is having, you know, somewhere in the order of 15 million people out of work, and this means people can't support their families. This is a real catastrophe for those people. So in that context, I think we do need fast growth. And just by comparison, when we had steep downturns in the 70s and 80s, the economy is growing 7 or 8% the year following those downturns. So we're looking at real weak growth by historic standards. Now, the second point, I'm all for shorter work weeks. My big ally on this is Kevin Hassett at the American Enterprise Institute, who's usually on the other side of political arguments with me. But we're just talking about making the workplace more flexible. As it stands now, if I get unemployed, the government pays me to be fully unemployed. What we're saying is, why don't we structure it so that they could pay people to be partly unemployed? So rather than have someone be out of work completely, suppose you have them work 10%, 20% fewer hours, and they'll take home somewhat less pay, but not hugely less. I think that's a much better way to go.
David.
Well, I think the problem is that what we don't want to do is just have the same amount of unemployment and spread it around. That is a share the pain thing, and there's a good argument for that. But it doesn't really solve the fundamental problem, which is there just isn't enough work to go around. And I think it's a bit defeatist to say, well, all the best we can do is share the misery. It is interesting, though, and Dean mentioned this earlier, that the Germans have a different approach. And when times were booming here, it didn't look so good because they didn't create as many jobs as we did. They had more people who were on the sidelines permanently. They didn't enjoy some of the benefits of productivity growth that we had. And it seemed like on the upside, our system was better. But then we ran this experiment on the downside, and it may be that they may smooth the peaks and smooth the valleys. So it may be a better strategy in the downtime to have more of this work sharing and stuff. But I don't think we should settle for that.
Right.
Well, I think one thing this recession has done is brought forth some new kind of labor management relationships that you've seen a lot of businesses that they've often asked some employees, how do you want to share the pain? Layoffs versus salary cuts, for example. And employees kind of get together and say, instead of having layoffs, maybe we'll all take 10%, we'll take some time off. And so, you know, that if there's a silver lining, it might be interesting to see if some of these real innovative labor management techniques are kept in place going forward. And I think the important thing is try to keep the flexibility in the private sector where, you know, management labor can negotiate these techniques going forward instead of putting anything in stone and establishing a more rigid labor system.
Here's an email from Tom. Would your panel talk about corporate responsibility? Don't you think it's time for corporations to put patriotism ahead of profits? Stop firing, start hiring. Then I think the rest of us will support those corporations that do help with our dollars. David?
Well, I think that corporations are in business to make money, and they do what they see as in their best interest. That's the way our system works. And especially big multinational corporations have lots of alternatives of places to produce. Have lots of global businesses, are being able to take advantage of the fast-growing Chinese economy and stuff like that. And I just don't think that appealing to creating jobs isn't like giving money to the United Way to them. We have to do stuff that makes it profitable for them to hire workers in the United States, and that may mean increasing demand. That's what Dean would say. It may mean reducing regulations. That's what Ray would say. But I just don't think that if the president of the United States went out and told all the Fortune 500 to hire 50 people, that it would actually do any good.
I largely agree with what Dave was saying, but I would qualify it a little bit in that you've had some companies that made a point of sort of advertising their work policies. They advertise that they have a Buy America policy, that they have Costco, for example. It makes a point of saying it pays its workers somewhat better than, say, Walmart does. And that's part of their business marketing. Now, they're profitable companies, you know, so they're doing this in the pursuit of making a profit. I don't think we can expect corporations are going to do things that actually cost them money, but sometimes doing something that might be in the best interest of the community, the country, their workforce may actually be a way towards greater profitability.
All right. To Bedford, Texas. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
You are a treasure.
Thanks.
What I just wanted to say was I'm one of the fortunate people that I'm retired and I do have a pension, but I know many people that don't. I'm not going to spend any more than I have to because I don't think the fundamentals have changed. And I think the average person isn't worried about dividends and a lot of the things that your guests are talking about. I think what we're worried about is we see our government dumping tons, you know, billions of dollars down two wars, down two rat holes, while we're firing cops and firefighters and teachers in this country. We see corporations still offshoring jobs because their profits are tied to Wall Street, and they're going to do what they need to do to make all the money. We still see bad trade agreements where our products that are still made here are not purchased overseas. We don't have the same kind of, you know, agreements that favor us, tariffs put on ours. Stuff coming in here is not, and we don't trust Wall Street. I don't trust them. I don't trust the big corporations. I just think they're out to, you know, come up with whatever deal they can to make a quick profit.
Thanks for calling, Diane. First, the wars. How much are they draining the U.S. Treasury, Dean Baker?
Well, they're a big cost. I looked back a little while ago at what the projected spending was, military spending for 2010, back before the September 11th attack, and we were projected to spend about 2.4% of GDP, which would be a bit over $300 billion. We're spending close to twice that. So it is a big drain. Now, in the current economy where we need demand, in that sense, it's not that much of a drain. We need demand in the economy. That's not the best way to do it. I mean, I'd rather see have demand, you know, weatherizing our homes, you know, making the economy more energy efficient. But it does generate demand. So it's not that much of a drain in the current context. Going forward, though, where we do get concerned about our deficit, say, once the economy has recovered, that will be a big drain. And it's something we're going to have to talk about very seriously.
What about exports, David Wessel?
Well, I think that what the caller raises is a question you hear a lot, which is somehow is the whole world deck stacked against the United States?
Right now.
And of course, the smart answer to that is some. It's not as bad as some people make out. It's not like we don't have big exporters in the United States. It is a huge problem. Everybody in the world cannot export their way out of this problem, and unfortunately, most of the major economies of the world seem to have that as a strategy, and that's a little tough because someone has to be a buyer in this thing. It is clear that a number of the trade agreements have gotten a bad name, even those that would open markets abroad. But it is also true that the fruits of globalization are not evenly shared in the United States, and that we've paid very little attention to how do we make sure that the prosperity that comes from global trading, which I believe is true, is well distributed and not just concentrated in people who have the good fortune to work in businesses that are the global winners.
Is Diane making a fair comparison between the money spent on wars and the firing of cops, teachers, so on? Ray?
I don't think so, because I think it's coming from two, you know, different pools of money. You have, you know, the federal government, and then you have the state and local sector. I mean, it's important to
isn't it all one big pool?
Well, you know, you have taxes going to the federal government, taxes going to state and local. If you want to assume all taxes are the same, then you could argue that. But let's realize that, you know, state and local workers, the idea that there have been massive layoffs hasn't really come true. The state and local workforce is down less than 0.5% since the recession started. Compare that to the private sector, where private sector jobs have lost 7% of the total private sector workforce. And we've seen that private sector workers have borne far and away the brunt of this recession going forward.
Look, war is not an economic strategy. The argument for the war is, if you believe it, is it's necessary for our national security and it's good to deal with Iraq and Afghanistan, or it isn't. And if it is, it's worth the cost. And if it isn't, no amount of money is worth the cost. And so I think it's kind of mixing apples and oranges to sort of compare that to copper.
But didn't one of our senior government officials say recently that the deficit is a matter of national security?
He did say that. I think he was a little carried away on that because, again, if you look at the projections for deficits, debt, you have to go a long way before you can really talk about this jeopardizing our national security. Now, does this mean that the Pentagon's not going to get every penny it wants? Well, that's probably true. I think that should always be true because just like any government bureaucracy, they're going to want more than probably is warranted.
I think one thing the three of us could agree on is that we probably don't want the generals running the economy and we don't want the economists running the wars.
Right.
And there was a little bit of mixing, I think, of competence there.
Yeah.
Well, it's a problem.
It's definitely a problem, but I'm not sure Admiral Mullen is the one to fix it.
All right, let's go to Old Mystic, Connecticut. Good morning, Eva. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and your guests. In all the talk about housing reform, I've heard nothing about stopping or outlawing securitizing mortgages. If a bank can get rid of its mortgages, why should it care if a person they grant a mortgage to is a bad credit risk? I really believe that's the greatest cause of banks gone wild. And don't we still allow securitization of mortgages?
Well, look, the two things. One is there's a lot to be said for securitization. It does make more credit available and spread the risk. But I think you'll be glad to know that at least one thing that they did in the financial regulatory bill is to say that the one that's passed Congress will probably finish before the month's out, is to say that if you're in the business of making loans and you sell it as a security, you can't get rid of all the risk. That if the buyer doesn't make good on the loan, you too are going to have to get some pain. And I think it's a response to the concern that you expressed, which is a legitimate one, but also allows us to have some of the benefits of securitization, which have made credit more widely available.
Just to carry that a step further, though, the secondary mortgage market predates securitization. Fannie Mae created that back in the 30s, and what that meant was a bank or savings and loan could sell its mortgage to Fannie Mae, get more money to issue more mortgages. For the most part, that worked fairly well. Obviously, in the last decade, it really did not, but for the most part, that was a pretty good system in my
opinion. I think one of the shortfalls of the financial regulation bill is that we still haven't addressed the problem of Fannie and Freddie. I mean, we're looking at $150 billion dollars lost for taxpayer money. They're being delisted from Wall Street, and that reform is going to have to come within the next year or two.
Well, they wanted to leave something to do next year.
Here are two very different views of what's happening. One from Mark in Birmingham, Alabama, who says lots of talk about why and how the recession happened, all the signs indicating we're still in it, why we're not coming out of it. All those sophisticated arcane arguments, lines of reasoning, skirt the very simple, inescapable, brutal truth, jobs. Until people have jobs that they are confident they will have in the future, everything else is superficial rhetoric. Now, here's a contrasting voice from Mark in Burlington, Vermont, who says the jobs are out there. I am semi-retired, sick and tired of all the whining. I was surrounded by, I can't find a job. So to prove a point, I go online, apply for 4 jobs, get hired for 3 of them. I live in a small market, so I visited 3 sites on Craigslist, Monster and Jobs in Vermont. So.
Well, I'd congratulate him on getting jobs. He's doing much better than most people. We actually have pretty good data on this. I mean, the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts a lot of effort into measuring job openings. They measure how many people are looking for jobs, and they find a ratio of roughly 5 people looking for jobs for every job opening. And, you know, again, no one's perfect. Their data's not perfect, but I think it's probably somewhere in the ballpark.
Dean Baker, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Richmond Heights, Missouri. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Diane. Another great show. I just want to counter some of the talk that's been going around this morning about how to fix the economy, and also to comment that I don't want economists running the economy.
Fair enough.
Good Probably a good idea.
Yeah. All right, we're with you.
The reason we got into this mess is because we've been managing people's freedom for a long time through the Federal Reserve, and we've been supplying the business interests with a lot of credit that they distribute, and we all take too much risk. And there's no way we're going to get out of this mess with additional stimulus. It can't work in the end. It works as long as the fabric is still there, but we've pretty much worn out the fabric of inflating, and we have to allow freedom essentially to reign. And I think that's the my main point.
Freedom, Ray?
Must be your topic.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's absolutely right that, you know, what we need to look to is reducing some of the regulation on business, being able to free up their enterprise. I think we also need to be concerned, and I think he's right to point a finger a little bit at the Federal Reserve Board for getting us in this mess. We know that we kept interest rates very, very low in the midst of a very sustained housing bubble, you know, with the idea that this time we understood all the risks, this time the bubble was for real, and it turns out that nobody was as smart as they thought they were, except maybe for Dean. But everybody got this wrong. And so that's kind of the mess that we're in right now. And so you need to try to go back to kind of the fundamentals, making sure that we have sustained growth instead of, you know, this fast bubble inflated growth sparked by low interest rates.
Dayton?
Well, I'll agree with blaming the Fed. I mean, it's unbelievably irresponsible not to attack the housing bubble. We need low interest rates. I'll say that because we had a very hard time coming out of the last recession. We didn't start creating jobs until 2003. So we had a hard time coming out of that recession. You needed the low interest rates, but they should have been aware of the bubble. That was a really big problem.
When are we going to begin to turn the corner, Dean?
Well, I really worry we're in a very, very bad downward cycle, that what you're looking at is a situation where people have soured on stimulus. I worry that there's this argument the Republicans, I think, don't want to see any stimulus. If they get score big in the election, I think it looks very bad for any further stimulus.
David?
I'm honestly, I don't know. I had hoped that this would be the point where we would be celebrating, but I don't think we're going to see it in the next 6 or 9 months.
David Wessel, the Wall Street Journal, author of In Fed We Trust, Dean Baker, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Ray Hederman of the Heritage Foundation. Thank you all. I'll try not to be dismal today. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.